This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. John Christopher Fisher, a.k.a. J.C. Fisher, on the 20th of April 2001 at approximately 10 o'clock Lubbock time. We are in the International Cultural Center in Lubbock, Texas. Sir, why don't you go ahead and begin by telling me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Well, I was a military brat. So I was born in San Diego, California in 1939, and my father was transferred shortly after that to different places. I don't remember all of them from the early years, but he was transferred around. I know that one time we were at the Presidio of San Francisco. I knew that we were at Fort Ord, California, and other places. Because of what was told to me later on in life. Mm-hmm. I know that at one time we went to Arizona for one of the Air Force bases, Army Air Corps bases there. My father, when the Army and the when the Army Air Corps came into being, he chose to go into the Army Air Corps. And so he stated he was in the Army Air Corps during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And after the Second World War, when the Army Air Corps was going to split off from the Army and become the Air Force and the Army, he decided to stay with the Army. So he stayed with the Army. And we lived, I know we lived in Oklahoma and several places in Texas during our his military career. Mm-hmm. We ended up at Fort Sam Houston. And at Fort Sam is, well, in San Antonio, Fort Sam Houston, San Antonio, Texas, is where I eventually joined the service and went on.
Now, growing up as a military brat, mm-hmm. Did you enjoy that lifestyle, or is that one of the reasons why you decided to go into the military yourself? You didn't mind moving around and things like that?
I didn't mind moving around. I enjoyed that. In fact, my father had a basic training unit at Fort Sam Houston. And during the summer when I was off from school, I used to get to go down there and watch the soldiers. And they even, some of the people even taught me how to fire the weapons and clean them and take care of them. I was boot camp for me in the summertime. Mm-hmm. I went on the marches with them and the bivouacs and everything else. And so I kind of had a good taste of military life, and when it came time for me to be the right age, I just, hey, I'm going into the military. Okay. And that's what I did.
Okay. Now, was there anything that you enjoyed about school? You mentioned before that you left school early, but mm-hmm. I was just wondering, even though you left early, if there was anything you did enjoy, but it just wasn't enjoyable enough?
I was literally bored with school. Mm-hmm. And there was no enjoyment in it whatsoever with me. That's why I quit high school in the 10th grade and went on active duty with the Navy. I might say that after the year, I was in the Navy for a year, and they came to me and they said, well, we can't promote you to a first class, a seaman first class, until you've completed your high school. So they sent me down to take a GED test. And when the results came back, they were a little shocked because they said, well, the level of the test that you graded at is way above the level of education that you've got. You scored too high for your level of education. And so they had me go in and take some kind of a smartness test. I don't know what they call it. Mm-hmm. And they said I had an extremely high IQ. For a non-high school graduate, but I don't know. I guess I was just bored in high school, and that's why I quit.
Mm-hmm. So you passed your GED.
With flying colors.
And got promoted.
got my promotion to seaman first class, and eventually I became a leading seaman. This is one of the seamen that's senior to the others, and is kind of used as used to teach the younger sailors what they're to do and how things run on a ship. Mm-hmm. And just before I got out of the Navy, I took my test for third class, petty officer. But I knew I couldn't be promoted to the third class because I had not re-enlisted. This was back when you just didn't make rank real fast. You had to have 4 years in the Navy before you could even be a third class petty officer. Mm-hmm. But I went down and took the test, and the day I was signing my paperwork to go home, they told me, they said, well, you passed the test. And I said, well, I've decided to go, I'm going to go. So I got out for a year.
Okay.
Stayed out of the Navy for a year, and then a year later, see, I got out in June of 60. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like civilian life. I made it through about 11 months of civilian life, and I said, no, I don't like the way these people work. There's no teamwork. There's no respect for each other. There's no fellowship. I said, you just don't have the camaraderie in a civilian job. So I decided to go back in the service. And at that time, the Navy was not taking prior service people back into the Navy. But the Army recruiter came over and says, hey, I've got a job for you. I said, oh, okay, I'll take it. So I went into the Army. And basically what I became was I had my infantry basic, and then I had my infantry advanced training. I trained in the infantry for several years. And the rank wasn't too fast in the infantry. In fact, it was extremely slow. So I transferred over. One of the fields that was open was artillery. I transferred over to artillery. And just after I transferred, the rank became very slow in the artillery. And I transferred into military intelligence after that. And I stayed there for a couple of years. Well, I stayed in military intelligence for a year and a half before I went to Vietnam.
Okay.
So.
Now, what did you do in the Navy?
In the Navy?
Mm-hmm.
I was a diver in the Navy. Mm-hmm. I was a qualified scuba diver.
Mm-hmm.
And I also worked with special weapons, which was nuclear weapons. I was not in charge of them, but whenever nuclear weapons were being moved between ships or if they were being loaded or something, we had to have a special officer, special petty officer, and special seaman out there to handle these weapons, and everyone else was kind of cleared from the area.
Mm-hmm.
I guess because of the classification of them. And so I used to run the winches loading them into the cargo bays of the ammo ships.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically my job.
Mm-hmm.
Handling nuclear weapons and then going down and tying them down and preparing them for shipment or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got someplace, we would unload them. That was basically what I did. I handled a lot of small boats when I was in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
I was a gig coxswain. I was actually a bosun's mate.
Mm-hmm.
But as a bosun's mate, you're a jack of all trades.
Mm-hmm.
And so any job they gave you, you were supposed to be able to do, and that's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did when I was in the Navy.
Okay.
And that's the background I had.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the intelligence work that I was doing, it was just very minor stuff, nothing big about it. But I learned a little bit about intelligence. That's how I got into some of the things that I got into later in the military.
Okay. When you were working with special weapons and loading and unloading atomic or nuclear weapons, these are not weapons that were fired from the ship. These were just transport?
Yes, they were transported. Right. We had no way of delivering nuclear weapons at that time from the ships.
Right.
So we would carry them to specific places and drop them off I never knew what happened to them after we released them, but we had to make sure that the serial numbers matched and everybody had to triple, quadruple sign for this and that. And when you worked with those things, nobody could be around. There was only, I never saw so many guards in my life, except when we were unloading nuclear weapons overseas. Tremendous guarding.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Navy installation where we were at the time when we offloaded some nuclear weapons in Hawaii one time, they closed the post.
Wow.
They would let nobody on or off. Of course, they wouldn't let anybody around our ships either, but they closed the post so that nobody could get in and take pictures. And we had patrol boats in the water and everything. I think they overreacted, but that was the way they did things.
Mm-hmm. Were most of your was most of your sea duty for those? I see you were in the Navy active duty from 57 to 60, so mm-hmm. 3 years. Was most of that in the Pacific?
Yes, it was,
or
all of
was all in the Pacific.
Yeah, it was all in the Pacific. Yeah.
Where else? Where else besides Hawaii did you go?
Oh, we were in Kwajalein Island. We were at Guam. Mm-hmm. We were in Midway. We went to Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, and at the time it was called Formosa. I'm sorry, it's Taiwan now, but it was called Formosa at the mm-hmm. time. And we went to Australia.
Okay. Were all of these? Did all of these include delivering nuclear weapons, or just
no
select few?
Just a select few, but yeah. The ship still made ports of call throughout places.
Gotcha. Okay. What were the most important lessons or the most important things you took away from your 3 years experience active duty in the Navy that helped you later on in your military career in the Army? Or was there anything that kind of transferred over?
What I really learned a lot about as a bosun's mate is I learned how to handle small boats, LCBPs, LCM, Peter boats, Mike boats, LCUs, landing ships, like that. I also ran a motor well boat, and I also ran a captain's gig. Mm-hmm. So I was able to handle small boats and navigate on my own, which was came in handy later on. I learned how to handle cargo, especially very sensitive cargo, loading and offloading, how mm-hmm. to tie it down, how to brace it and shore it up on a ship and things like this for movement. So, yeah, I had I carried on some of that to my other military career in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I would imagine that also helped as we get later on and look at your advisory work with the 17th Riverboats.
Oh yeah,
that was probably important.
Oh, that was very important. Yeah.
Okay. That year or so, or less than a year, the 11 months that you had between your Navy career and your Army career, what did you do as a civilian?
I took a job with Sears Roebuck and Company, working in their warehouse as a delivery man and a deluxer on the stuff that we delivered. You know, if something got scratched or something, I'd go out and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
But the money just wasn't there for livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I felt that I miss. You know, we learned to work in the Navy. We learned to work as teams.
Mm-hmm.
The ship didn't get loaded unless everybody pitched in.
Right.
And that meant from the skipper, whatever his rank might be at the time. Our skipper was a lieutenant commander, what we call in the Army a lieutenant colonel. He came down and took his shirt off just like the rest of us and helped us load.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our officers pitched in. So we got used to working as teams. When we were at sea, if we had to resupply a ship at sea with ammunition, you had to work together. Everybody had to pitch in. Everybody had a job. And even then, you know, the skipper would come down and he would pitch in and make sure things were being done and help out and everything. So these are things that I had really missed from the military, the union that you had with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned from each other. Everybody knew what my weaknesses were. I knew what everybody else's weaknesses were. So when it came to doing work on the deck, hazardous work, I knew, okay, we don't put this guy in charge of this job because this is his weakness, but he's great over here, so we'll put him over here and take this guy that's over here, which is his weakness, and put him over here where he's the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to work like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I missed. The fellowship. At nights we would go on the fantail and sit there, and a couple of guys played guitars and another one an accordion, and we'd sit on the fantail smoking and singing songs and mm-hmm. talk about home and talk about school and things like this. So this was missing in the civilian world. At the end of the day, everybody went home. And you were on your own. So if you didn't have friends or something, that, you know, the associates that you could go to, you were just nothing to do. And that's what I felt from the military. I learned the companionship, the camaraderie, and the teamwork. And that carried over from the Navy into the Army for me.
Okay. When you went into the Army in 1960, and you said you wanted to go back to the Navy, they weren't taking back prior service. Army guy said, hey, we can take you. Did you purposely choose infantry, or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I purposely chose infantry.
Okay.
I don't know why at the time, but I knew it was the combat arms. I knew that if there was a war or anything, that the infantry would be the first on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I felt that I had this warrior instinct.
Mm-hmm.
My father had fought in two wars. He fought in World War II, and he fought in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to sit around and listen, you know, as a kid to their war stories and things that went on and all this. And I always thought, I want to be a soldier. I want to fight a war. This is my country, and I want to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I went into the infantry.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you listen to the war stories, was it just your father, or were there other people that you interacted with and you listened to?
Oh, his buddies would come over to the house, you know, and they would sit there and drink. And, they would talk about flying a B-17 and getting the tail all shut up and what they had to do to stay in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, man, wow. You know, for a little kid, I think it was, you know, it was fascinating.
Absolutely.
And they would talk about the amphibious landings in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
That they were involved with and the things that went on over there.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard the Japanese fought against them and how hard they had to fight to take over. And I don't recall them ever talking about blood and guts.
Mm-hmm.
They were talking, that most of it was funny stuff.
Mm-hmm.
About the war stories. Oh, do you remember when so-and-so did this or that or the other? And he got shot in the butt. Because we told him his butt was too big, and sure enough, he got shot in it. And that was a big laugh for people and things like that. And I guess it war intrigued me.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I used to go to all the World War II movies and see all that. And, geez, look at John Wayne and Audie Murphy and all these, wow, you know. So I guess I was oriented towards the military from a childhood.
Okay.
So that's why I guess I did what I did.
Mm-hmm. And what were the biggest differences when you finally did get on active duty in the Army? What were the biggest differences between serving in the Navy and serving in the Army from your perspective? Besides the fact that in the Navy you're at sea and in the Army you're on land.
Well, probably the biggest difference and the most problems I had was the military jargon.
Mm.
In the Navy, this was a deck.
Mm-hmm.
In the Army, it's a floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bulkhead. In the Army, it's a wall. That's an overhead. No, that's a ceiling. The latrine was a head. So I had a lot of trouble reorienting myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys in the Army used to hassle me, you know, tease me a lot about it. Hey, Swabby, are you ever going to get over this Navy stuff, you know? And I guess, and wearing the uniform, our uniforms were different.
Mm-hmm.
We went from a pullover shirt where you had to do a square knot in your tie that was worn down low, as to a four and hand knot that had to go up around your throat and choke yourself to death, you know. Wearing the uniform was different. Basic training was, as opposed to boot camp, the thing in basic training that I found from the Army and the Navy, we did more calisthenics in the Army, more physical exercise, and we trained on more weapons, and we were schooled more heavily on the weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And after basic training, of course, we went into our advanced individual training, AIT, and I went to AIT infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we really focused on infantry tactics and we focused on infantry weapons. And you had, of course, two types of weapons in the infantry. You have your individual weapons, and then you have your crew served weapons. Individual weapon was your rifle, your pistol, or your flamethrower, or your machine gun, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But a crew served weapon was the heavy 50 caliber machine guns, the mortar, the 30 caliber machine guns, the rocket launchers, and things like this. And you had to operate one of those, to even get one of those things into position to operate, it didn't take just one man to get there. You had to have one or two men carrying ammunition, another man carrying a barrel, another man carrying a receiver, another man carrying the tripod, mm-hmm. and set this thing up and put it together. And it was very quick, and that's where the teamwork came in. And so these were some of the differences, were mm-hmm. the types of weapons. Where on the ships we had, I think in boot camp we learned to fire a rifle, and I think that's all we fired in boot camp. But when we were on the ship, we had 5-inch guns, and during the combat situation, everybody had to handle a 5-inch gun. Mm-hmm. Now, in the infantry, you don't have 5-inch guns.
Well, the what would you say was more of a challenge for you personally? Was it Navy boot camp, Army basic training, or were there just difficulties in both?
They were very much the same as far as that went. They weren't all that difficult because my father had been in the military, mm-hmm. and I had done a lot of military things before I went in the military, so it was a walkthrough for me, really. The hardest part was getting up at 3:00 in the morning after 2 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. That was probably very difficult, but I fell right in with it. I already knew how to do the calisthenics and the exercises and things like that, so it wasn't that difficult.
Okay.
It was an easy transition for me.
What was the greatest challenge for you personally in your training, in neither the Navy or in the Army?
Well, geez, you're talking about many, many years ago.
If you can think of anything.
It's hard to think back to that time and think of what the challenges were. I guess the biggest challenge was just worried about not being able to complete boot camp. Mm-hmm. You know, what if I fall on my butt and I can't complete this? It would be, you know, personally it would be very discouraging.
Yes.
And so I think the challenges came at the beginning of training. You would look at this and you'd say, God, am I going to be able to do this? Well, you get through that. And then you go into another phase of training. Mm-hmm. And here you're going into a bigger field. And you look at everything that you have to learn to do and you say, shh, I'll never learn to do this. Mm-hmm. Well, you get through that. And you go into another phase of training, and it's the same thing. The training was the challenge, mm-hmm. because every time you advanced up, the training got wider, the scope of what you were doing got wider and broader, and just being able to get in there and do the job, mm-hmm. and learn it. They didn't just stick you in a job and say learn it; they taught you, and the process of learning actually is a very big challenge sometimes, especially when you go in and you say, well, in the next 6 weeks, we're going to learn how to do the next 16,000 tasks. 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and I want to learn 16,000 tasks? Jeez, you know. Mm-hmm. But you do. Mm-hmm. So those are the biggest challenges.
Okay. And after you got into the thick of Army training, did you have any second thoughts?
No. I never doubted what I was doing. I guess I had the upbringing of a military family, so I was very proud to wear my uniform. Mm-hmm. I wore my uniform whenever I could. I took immaculate care of my uniforms. I wouldn't have ropes hanging off of it. I wouldn't have the brass unshined. I would always have my shoes shined. I'd always have creases in my shirts and my trousers and everything. You might have heard of the phrase soaping a crease. Mm-hmm. That's where you took special kind of soap and literally ironed in your crease to look just like a knife edge. I mean, that's just the way I'd been brought up, and that's the way I looked at my uniforms. I always wanted, whenever I wore my uniform, I wanted to be sharp.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you did your infantry training at Fort Benning, Georgia, is that correct?
Yes.
Where was your first duty assignment in the Army? Your first unit? Do you remember?
Golly. Yes, I can. Now that I think about it, after all that AIT and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was in Texas. It was in a very strange town in Texas, just south of Dallas-Fort Worth area. They had a Air Defense Command post there, and they had us on guard duty because it was a classified installation.
Mm-hmm.
We became the guards for the installation.
Okay.
It was a high security area.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess with my previous background, I guess they felt that I was not a security risk. So,
mm-hmm.
I had to go through security clearances and... my father had obtained a top secret security clearance in the Army, and when I went in, I had no trouble obtaining one either.
Mm-hmm.
So I was highly classified or highly qualified to go into secure areas. So that my first duty assignment as an infantryman, there was no war going on, so
mm-hmm.
there was no place for infantrymen to be used except in mundane type jobs. And so I ended up in security at that installation there. And from there, I went to the Presidio of San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and I was at the Presidio for a while. I was also, again, a security guard for an Air Defense Command post on Mount Tamalpais. And after I'd been there a while, they were looking for people to go into the 6th Army Honor Guard. That was at Presidio, San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in, applied, and the day I went down, of course I had on the immaculate uniform, everything spit shine and everything in the right place, and oh yeah, this is a good troop, he's strike, he's sharp. So I spent 9 months on the 6th Army Honor Guard,
mm-hmm.
Which I found out was a whole lot tougher, because... whenever you had parades, you were always out there. For every military function, you had to show up. And you had more uniforms issued than you'd ever seen before. And everything had to be perfect. And that was the only way you got into an honor guard.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I was getting ready for a reassignment after that. And somebody said something about, why don't you put in for the 3rd Infantry Regiment in Washington, D.C.? And this is the Presidential Honor Guard in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, don't want any part of that. I want to go to Europe. And so I went to Europe, ended back up. Well, first time in Europe, I ended up at Baumholder, Germany, as it was in the infantry. And there, all we did was train to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had an Air Defense Command post that was some people got into that had broken through the security one time down in Würzburg. And so, because I'd had guard duty on security posts on highly classified installations before I got shipped down there. And I was in the infantry, but assigned to the artillery, Air Defense Command, missile artillery. And I stayed down there for a while, then I got shipped to another place in Germany for a big Air Defense Command post where we had air police and air police security and army security. That was Birkenfeld, Germany. And I stayed there for a while. And Vietnam came along. I started hearing about what was going on in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to my commander and I said, I want to put in an application to go to Vietnam. He said, no, we need you here. And I said, but I said, this is what I've trained for. I want to go to Vietnam. He said, nope, can't replace you. And so I put in the request to go anyway, and he disapproved it. And of course, once the company commander disapproves it, everybody up the line automatically does, because they don't want to override a company commander.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of made me a little angry that they wouldn't let me go. And I sat down and wrote a letter to the Secretary of the Army. I don't know where I got the balls to do that with, but I did. I sat down, wrote him a letter, and I said, I want to go to Vietnam, and the people here say I'm too important to be in Vietnam. And I said, but I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And not in those words, but that's just the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a very nice letter back from him. He says, I've forwarded your application for reassignment to Vietnam to the United States Army here, and if they look at your records and decide that you're qualified, they want you, I'm sure they'll send you. If they feel that you are more needed in Europe than young man, I want you to do your duty.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 months later, here come my orders for Vietnam.
What did your CEO say?
My CEO had been informed that I had written to the Secretary of the Army, because the letter came down through the chain of command.
Okay.
And my CEO called me in, and he was upset at me, but he made the comment. He said, now I understand how badly you want to go. He said that you would go and write a letter like this. And I said, well, I said, I want to. He says, well, get ready.
You're going.
He said, you're going.
Okay.
And so that's how I come to go to Vietnam.
Now, what do you remember about some earlier activity, not in Vietnam, but in terms of heightened political and almost military activity, in particular the Bay of Pigs invasion, excuse me, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Do you recall when that happened? Do you remember where you were?
Let's see.
Was anybody in your area, or were you put on alert?
Where was the Cuban? What was the Cuban Missile Crisis?
That was in October of 62.
I was in Europe. Yeah, that's right. We were in Europe at that time. And
okay.
We were put on a high alert status over in Europe.
Okay.
Yeah. That was something I had forgotten even happened. In fact, I think I was in Birkenfeld, Germany at the time.
Okay.
And we went on heightened alert and everything.
Right.
And we were taken inside the Air Defense Center. And they even taught us to do some of the jobs in there on our free time.
Mm-hmm.
But we were on a higher alert status when that was going on, and we had gotten alerted. The guards, the infantry guards there at the installation, had gotten alerted that we may be moved to Florida, because they were going to move a bunch of artillery, air defense artillery units to Florida, and they needed guards.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it never came about. Everything folded up. I knew there was a lot of saber rattling. That's what we called it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we phrased it in the military at the time was that everybody's got a case of indigestion, so they're rattling their sabers. But that's politics. I'm not involved, so whatever happens, happens.
Mm-hmm.
And the politics that went on, I guess, in the earlier part, I never paid attention to them. I was too involved in my military career.
Okay. And what did you hear was going on in Vietnam when you made your decision to put in your paperwork to go? And what did you think the United States was trying to accomplish there?
Well, the war was not too highly publicized at that time. But what I understood of the assignments to Vietnam at the time is the people that were going to Vietnam were being assigned to Vietnamese units as advisors. And I was a little old spec 4 at the time, and I thought, gee, get to be an advisor, man.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be cool, you know, help somebody learn something and be a teacher. That's what I looked at as the advisory duty, is being a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was cool. I said, yeah, that's why I want to go. I want to go do that.
Mm-hmm.
And But we heard that they were building up, the buildup was going on in Vietnam at the time. Mm-hmm. They were sending more forces over there, and they're getting ready to send in combat forces. And so that's why I volunteered. And I got my orders for Vietnam, and I packed all my gear up in Germany, came back to the States. And they made me wait in the States 30 days before they sent me to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And during that 30 days, I was given a passport and all kinds of documents that I needed, shots and stuff like that. I turned in all my uniforms, except for the khaki uniform I was wearing. And that's when I flew over to Vietnam in, was my short-sleeve khaki uniform. It's the only uniform I had. And when I got to Vietnam, we landed at the air base there. And they took us over to Long Bien. And they started issuing us all this combat gear that we were used to having anyway. And didn't bother me. I was used to having it all the time anyway. So, and then one day they came in and they said, "Sarge, with your background, you're being sent over to USRV." And I said, "Well, what's that?" They said, "That's U.S. Army Vietnam." I said, "I thought everybody was going to USRV." And they said, "Yeah, but you're going to Special Troops." And immediately I thought, "Oh, they're sending me to Special Forces." No, that wasn't it. Mm-hmm. I made the comment. I said, "Why are they sending me to Special Forces? I don't have any training for that." They said, no, Special Troops." And I immediately came to my mind, "Okay, we're going to be gophers. Go do this and go get me a cup of coffee and polish my shoes." And then I thought, "Oh God, this is not what I came to Vietnam for." But that's not what they were. We went out on special operations for USRV, and we did special programs for them. We'd go out in villages or something and try to teach the people things, which was what I had wanted to do.
Okay.
And I think that my later experience, one that came about with USRV as the Special Troops, is the one that really opened my eyes what was going on in Vietnam, because I was listening, of course, to everything that was being told to me by the U.S. government as, "This is true, man. This is the word. This is the truth. This is exactly how it's happening." And I was assigned to, with a unit, as a guard for a combat engineer unit to go up to Camelot Valley, mm-hmm. which was up around Phan Rang and Cameron Bay. And we were told that what we were doing is there was a village that was going to be that wanted to get away from communism, mm-hmm. and they couldn't in the area where they were. So we were going to set up the groundwork and build a village down in Camelot Valley for these Vietnamese people to move into, and we were going to build them new homes and everything like that. So what we had to do is we had to go in, we had to clear the area, make sure the VC were out of it and things like this, no minefields around. And we did. We literally built concrete block houses with thatched roofs and all this, and I learned a lot about construction. And we did all this work. It took us about 6-7 months in there. Mm-hmm. And one day they started bringing in the Vietnamese villagers that were going to live here. Mm-hmm. And I saw this one woman. She had two babies in her arms, two little bitty babies. Mm-hmm. And she was on the back of a deuce and a half, and I reached up to help her. And she glared at me and ripped loose with some Vietnamese. And of course, I didn't understand it. And we had an interpreter there, and I said, "I'm just trying to help this woman." And he said to me, he said, "She does not want to be touched by an American." I said, "What's the problem here?" He said, "Don't you know?" And I said, "No." He said, "These are people that have been moved off of land that they had lived on for hundreds of years, their families. And they're being moved by the Vietnamese government against their will." All this time, we've been told we're doing something special for these special people that want to move. Mm-hmm. And now I'm learning that these people were being taken off their homesteads. Their village was burned to the ground. The gravestones were taken up. Everything. The place was literally destroyed. And these people were not happy with this. And he told me, he says, this woman's saying this because the American soldiers are here. And this was the first time I'd heard that the people weren't happy with us being in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And that kind of opened my eyes a lot to what was going on. And then, of course, I started getting nosy and I started talking to people. Right after that, I got transferred down to Saigon. I went down there to pull security at the airbase at Tan Son Nhut. And that's when I put in my application to go to MACV because I wanted to get out of USRV. I felt they weren't doing with the propaganda that the American government was putting out. I didn't feel that we were doing that. Mm-hmm. I felt we were doing something different to that. So I put in for MACV because I'd heard some advisors talk about what MACV was and what they were doing. So I put in for that and got assigned to MACV. And because they were needing advisors badly. And that's how I got into MACV. I went over to MACV and I got this briefing. I don't remember how many days I was there or what, but I got a briefing from these people who were running MACV. And a lot of the briefing was teaching us some of the customs of Vietnam. Not much language training at all. We were going to have to learn that on our own. But we were learning the customs and the way their military was formed and their chain of command and some of the idiosyncrasies of the Vietnamese people. And but this one thing that sticks out in this whole briefing of, I don't know, many 5, 6, 7 days of briefings was that we were going to go into a Vietnamese unit and we were going to tell them and teach them how to fight this war. And I thought, great, this is really an opportunity. Well, another disappointment. When I got to the unit that I was being assigned to, which was the 17th Riverboat Company down in Mito, I ran into the captain, this Navy captain that was in charge of this boat company, and he spoke some English, and I spoke a little Vietnamese by then. And in our first discussion, in our first meeting, he was telling me about his war experiences. I was hearing war stories from this dude dated back to the 40s. And how he had fought the communists, how he had fought against the Japanese, he fought against the communists, he fought against the French, he fought against the English. And he said, here I am again fighting against the communists. And I thought to myself, this guy has got to have 20-some years experience fighting wars. What am I going to, why did they tell me I'm down here to teach him how to fight this war? And here again was this disillusionment of why I was there. Mm-hmm. I guess somewhere along in there I stopped trusting my government. Okay. I don't know exactly when that happened, but I got to when they told me something, I just didn't believe a word they were saying. It was like, you can't trust them. Because mm-hmm. every time they say something in Vietnam, you'd find out something different. And you knew that somebody was lying to you. And I think that was, for me, that was discouraging.
Let me ask you some clarifying questions real quick. When you first arrived in Vietnam and eventually went to work for USRV, what kind of briefings did you receive upon arriving in country? You know, where did you arrive in country?
Well, I arrived at Tan Son Nhut.
Tan Son Nhut.
Yeah. As to briefings, we were told we could go downtown, you know, go on pass and go to town. Mm-hmm. But we had to stay away from the women because all the women were VC and they were full of venereal diseases. Mm-hmm. We were told to stay out of certain parts of Saigon and Cho Lan. And not to stand in groups on the street corners, don't ride on sickalos, and don't eat the food. We were given a little book on courtesies and customs of the Vietnamese, and they said, well, you really don't have to read the book, we'll brief you on it. They briefed us on it that the Vietnamese didn't like their women messed with, and you didn't harass the Vietnamese downtown and things like this. And we went downtown, and the girls messed with us. We didn't mess with them. I mean, the girls were climbing all over us because they wanted our money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad when I went up to Cameron Bay, because when I went up to Cameron, I got away from the city of Saigon and Tudo Street, where, you know, I had gone to some of the restaurants in Saigon because I wanted to learn the food.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to learn some of the customs. Man, the food was good. I never got sick from it. I tried to stay out of any places that were off limits. And Saigon was bar after bar after bar after bar. And you could walk by a bar and four or five girls come out and try to drag you in, buy me Saigon tea and all this, you know. No, come on, you know. This is not what I'm here for. And down on the black, we had a PX there. And you could buy a lot of stuff at the PX. But I would go down in the area, down in Saigon, where the black market was. And you could buy stuff on the black market you couldn't get in the PX. And you could buy stuff on the black market that was being bought in the PX, put on the black market at twice the price.
Mm-hmm.
But I figured, you know, with other experiences I'd had in the military, I said, well, this is about par. You know, the people are just trying to make a living.
Right. What did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam when you first arrived? How did you understand the mission?
According to the briefings, we were there to help the Vietnamese win the war between the North and the South. The communists were overrunning the lower portion of South Vietnam because they wanted to take over and unite the Vietnamese people into one country. And the people in South Vietnam did not want that. And they were not able to fight the war by themselves, so we were there to help them. That's basically the bullshit that was put out by the government.
When did you start questioning that?
When I got assigned to my advisory team down in the Delta.
Okay. That's 66.
That's when I started questioning what was going on.
Okay.
Because here I was. I was an E6 in the United States Army. And here was this Vietnamese captain that had 20 years of combat service. And I was supposed to teach him how to win the war.
Right.
That was a bunch of phooey.
Mm-hmm.
Is exactly what it was. I eventually found out that what I could do is I could help the Vietnamese in other ways, and that's what I did.
Okay. Again, when you were with USRV and working with the special troops, how much time did you spend in Saigon, and then what you left eventually, as you pointed out, went to Cameron Bay and worked around there. How long did you stay in Cameron?
Let's see, we were in Saigon, maybe.
I guess it was Cam Lot Valley.
Yeah. We were in Saigon maybe two weeks. Mm-hmm. We went to Cameron Bay. While we were in Cameron Bay, we helped an artillery unit set up, an air defense artillery unit set up its operations on one of the hills around the base there.
Mm-hmm.
We did pull some security around the air base on the beach. They had a big beach out there, beautiful white beach.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out on guard duty in our swimsuits. And you know, it was kind of nobody around. We were just out there to be guarding it, so we'd go out there in our swimsuits and walk in the water because it was so hot. You know, mm-hmm. Nothing was happening. And it was funny. They had us out there in the daytime guarding this beach, but at nighttime they had no guards on the beach, which did not make much sense to me. Mm-hmm. That's when you should have had the guards there, I thought. But no, somebody with infinite wisdom in the higher echelons was not doing that. Mm-hmm. But we spent, I guess I spent almost a year in Cameron. Mm-hmm. We went up to the Trang several times. There was a island out there at the Trang called Han Tre Island. Mm-hmm. And there was an air defense unit being set up out there. And the Navy Seabees were setting up a unit out there. And we went up there to clear the island. The only thing we did was scare the hell out of the monkeys. There was no people on the island, no evidence of people being on the island or anything. And so we sat around and played poker and searched for souvenirs for several months while they were building Han Tre Island. I really wasn't happy with that because I wasn't in the war. There was nothing going on as far as the war went. I think the closest I came to the war is after we finished at Han Tre, we went to Camelot Valley mm-hmm. to start that project. Mm-hmm. And we found some areas where the VC had campsites. But they were old and abandoned. Mm-hmm. So we never had any contact. Well, we had a little contact a couple of times, but just little skirmishes and... that was my first contact with Aussie troops. Hmm.
Camelot?
At Camelot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Camelot. I think it was Camelot. Camloc, Camelot Valley.
Okay.
That was our first time that we ran into Aussies over there, Australians. They had been doing some operations up inside of Camelot Valley, way up by the Trang, mm-hmm. and were going down to Phan Rang, so they came through the valley. And we asked them about the valley, you know, and they said, yeah, it's clear. They walked, it was a piece of cake, walked through. Hmm. They did not run into any VC units or anything.
Okay.
So that was no big worry of ours. And, of course, then I said after that, I was a little disillusioned with USRV and what we were doing. Mm-hmm. So I applied for assignment to MACV and got it. Then I went to the Delta.
Okay.
But you had some other questions there about what I was doing?
Well, especially with the special team and the special troops and your work in Camelot. How long were you there in Camelot? And you mentioned the woman who felt hostility towards Americans and what had been happening. Did you encounter others that felt the same way from like she did?
From those trucks, the people getting off of the trucks were extremely hostile to us. They didn't want us to help them. Mm-hmm. The interpreter that was there, I would say, what did this man say? He says, you people did a very bad job of building the houses. I said, we built them the way they were blueprinted. Well, that's not the way the Vietnamese built a house. I said, well, that's not my fault. You know, Vietnamese in Saigon designed these houses. Why are they taking this out on us? Well, you're Americans.
You're the foreigner on the soil.
You're the foreigner on the soil. Yeah, that's the way to look at it. You're the foreigner. You're Americans. They don't want you here. And I thought, what a bunch of crap. Why are we here if the Vietnamese don't want us? Mm-hmm. Later on with MACV, when I was down in some of the villages, and I had learned to speak a lot more Vietnamese, I heard it from a lot of Vietnamese. Why don't you people just go home, leave us alone, and let us live our lives? And I even a couple of times tried to explain to them. I says, well, you know, if we just pull out, the communists are going to take over. And they said, a lot of them living out in the villages, not where the government was, but they were living out in the hamlets and the way out.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you people don't understand. If you just leave, the war will stop. And we can go on and do our farming and live our lives on these, on our land that we've lived on for hundreds of years. And I thought, this doesn't coincide with what I've been taught. And I was dealing with a lot of mixed feelings, I guess, at that time. And I was a young kid. And sometimes I even got the attitude, what are we doing here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was that old song, Please, Mr. Custer, Send Me Home, What Am I Doing Here? I developed an attitude because the people really didn't want us.
Mm-hmm.
That I was finding in the villages. Now, this might not be true every place, but a lot of the contact I had in the little villages, they didn't care who was in charge of the government. Whoever was in charge of the government was going to be corrupt anyway. And they would just pay their taxes. As long as they were left to live on their land, that's all they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is where politics came in.
And just one last question about mm-hmm. your USRV. How long were you at Kamluck? Months? A couple of months?
Probably 3, 4, 5 months. Some of that stuff just went so fast, didn't even pay attention to it.
Okay. When you put in your paperwork to go to MACVI, did you know automatically that you were going to become an advisor? Or did you think that maybe you'd be doing something else?
I knew they needed advisors. They were sending information out to the units about requesting, if you have anyone that's qualified or thinks it's qualified that might want to be an advisor, please forward their names and
mm-hmm.
to MACV headquarters and that. And when I put my name in, my name went on the list. And I think it was within a week and a half. I got called and told that I was being transferred to MACV, and I would report the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So I cleared my unit in one day and checked into MACV the next morning. At the time we went into Copler Compound, and that was the MACV headquarters then in Saigon. And we went into Copler. I think the first day in Copler, we drew some bedding and got a room to sleep in and things like that. And then the next day our briefings started.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they started out with all these great things that we were going to do as advisors and what we were going to accomplish and how we were going to help win the war and things like that. And our briefings lasted for 5 days, and they gave us they gave us booklets that we were supposed to read at night, and all kinds of things that we were supposed to do's and don'ts with the Vietnamese, customs of the Vietnamese, and then our final briefing. Before we drew our equipment to go out into the teams, our final briefing was the one where this Army colonel came in and told us how great of a job we were going to do as advisors and how we were going to train these people and teach these people. We were going to have, we were set up training programs to train the people on their weapons and get their new weapons for them and orient them to the weapons it sounded great what we were going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I flew out on a Caribou, one of those little two-engine mm-hmm. planes that Australians were flying it. I think both of them were drunk as hell. The airport at Mito was about 100 feet long, water at both ends. And the pilot had to put the engines in reverse before the wheels touched the ground. And both pilots had to stand on the brakes to stop the plane before it ran off the end of the runway. And they said, they come back and they said, who's going to METO? And I said, that's me. And they said, here you are. And I grabbed my duffel bag, and I remember the weapon I had been issued was an M1 carbine from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not a big weapon, but that's what the advisors were supposed to carry because we weren't supposed to be fighting. That was only for self-protection.
Mm-hmm.
They put me off on the airstrip there. Nobody else there but me. And they turned the plane around, took off. And I waited for 3 hours before a Jeep finally showed up. And they said, are you the advisor? I said, yeah, I guess so. They said, well, come on, get in the Jeep. And they took me to the team headquarters there in METO. And I talked to Colonel Showalter. He was our senior advisor at the time. And he asked me if I really wanted to go out to this Navy unit. And I said, well, I really do. I said, that's what I'm sent down here for. He said, but you're in the Army. And he said, you don't want to be assigned to a Navy unit. I said, is there something else you want me to do? He says, well, we need somebody to handle our command radio program here in the team headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
I said, doing what? He says, well, manning the radio and at nights and things like this. And I said, Colonel, I did not volunteer to come down here to advisory duty to be in the headquarters and operate a radio. I said, I want to go out and advise this team. Well, you're an Army sergeant. You don't know anything about the Navy. And I said, sir, I spent time in the Navy. I know what I'm doing. He said, well, you're only an E6. And I said, well, this is an E6 that doesn't want to operate a radio. I said, can you get that through your head? He said, well, if you're going to be difficult, he said, we'll send you out in the morning. I spent the night there at the team house. Had pretty good food. And the next morning, Jeep took me down the main street of Mito. We made a left-hand turn, and we went through the marketplace, and we went through the school area. We went across a couple of canals, and we went out in the boonies. And I said, do you know where you're going? Oh, yeah, I know where I'm going. Pretty soon we got to this little bitty compound, and it was a Navy compound. This is where the boat company was. And they opened the gate for us. We went in. He dropped me off. He said, see you later, Sarge. Good luck, you know. I said, okay. Dumb. You know, I don't know. I really felt lost. And these Vietnamese came out and started talking to me, and I said, I don't understand Vietnamese. Finally, the Vietnamese captain came out, Dai Nguyen. And very polite, gentleman. He was always a gentleman to me. He came out, and I recognized this Vietnamese rank right away, and I popped to him, gave him a salute.
Mm-hmm.
And he returned it. He said, I'm very honored that you salute me. I said, well, you are an officer, and I always render a salute to an officer. He said, that's very kind of you, very noble of you, but from now on, please do not render salutes to officers. You are an advisor, and you do not have to salute us. I said, Dai Nguyen, I'm here to help you. He says, I know why you're here, Sergeant. He says, you are not going to teach me anything about the war. I have been fighting the war for 25 years. He says, but you can help my people. He said, and so everything you learned in Saigon, forget it. This guy's been around already. And he introduced me around to all of his officers, and they were very courteous and very respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And I found them honoring me, and I couldn't understand what this was all about. And I really never understood the attitude of their respect for me. I guess because I was an American. I don't know. But I was always respectful of them.
Mm-hmm.
I never tried to be pushy or anything like that. I was always trying to be respectful to them because I'm in their country.
Right.
And I think they respected that. We always had a lot of fun, though. But
now, were you instructed in any way concerning the relationship between you and your Daiwi, as you put it, in terms of the relationship between an enlisted officer, advisor, Daiwi?
I was just told that I was going to be going down to this Navy boat company,
mm-hmm.
and that I would be their advisor.
Advising them about?
And advising them on how to fight the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know the makeup of advisory teams at first,
mm-hmm.
but I learned later that a lot of teams consisted of 4 or 5 people. And I did question this one time after I'd been there a while. I said, aren't there supposed to be other advisors out there with me? And I was told, yes, you're supposed to have an officer. You're supposed to have an NCO that's a medic. You're supposed to have an NCO that's infantry qualified. You're supposed to have an NCO that's intelligence qualified. You're supposed to have a petty officer that's boat qualified. You're supposed to have a petty officer that's naval intelligence qualified. I said, okay, that's 6 people. And the colonel looked at me. He said, but Sergeant, he said, you fill 5 slots. The only thing that you can't fill is being the officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Colonel, do you realize I'm out there by myself? He says, can't help it, Sergeant. That's all we've got. We don't have the advisors to give you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just the situation I was being put in. I started feeling uneasy. But the Daiwi out there made me feel at home.
Mm-hmm.
I got a surprise the second day there. I was in, the Daiwi and I were talking, and by this time I'd already decided I'm not going to teach this man the war.
Mm-hmm.
He knows how to fight it. But we were sitting there talking in his office, and all of a sudden there was this hell of a commotion outside, and somebody was knocking on his door, and he told him to come in, and they said something to him. He said, oh, he says, okay, Kovan, come on, we got your first job for you. Said, my first job. What am I going to do? My first job. And they took me back to the back of the compound where the families lived. Over there, when the unit had a compound, the families lived with them. That I didn't like, but that's the way that was their culture. I found out that there was a wife back there ready to give birth to a child. And I kind of, Daiwi told me this, and I says, what am I supposed to do? Oh, you're the Koban. You're going to deliver the baby. I said, Daiwi, I'm not a fucking doctor. He says, oh, you're a Koban. You can do anything. Where did this guy get this? And what am I going to do? And so I thought real quick, and I said, what can I do, you know? I don't know what to do for this lady. So I told him, I says, listen, I'm going to need my radio.
Mm-hmm.
So he sent one of our enlisted men to get at the radio and bring it down there for me. And I got down there, and this woman was ready to deliver. And they pulled her dress up and they said, see? Man, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so I picked up, the guy had gotten there with the radio, and I picked it up real quick, and I keyed up, and I gave the call sign to the base camp, to the team headquarters. And they came on the radio, and they said, what do you need? I said, I need the medic on this radio, and I need him right now. Oh, what's going on down there? I said, there's a woman giving birth down here, and they want me to deliver this baby. Well, that's your responsibility. I said, hey, motherfucker, I am not a doctor. I don't know anything about this. Oh, okay, we'll go get the medic for you. So Sergeant Tom Woods was the medic. And so Sergeant Woods comes on the radio. He said, "What's going on?" And I said, "I'm down here and I'm supposed to deliver a baby." He said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." I said, "What do I do?" He says, "Well, I'll talk you through it." And he started asking me questions. I got one of the Vietnamese to hold the radio and key it for me. And it was a breech baby. And he told me how to reach in. And I said, "I'm supposed to stick my hands in this lady's, you know what?" And he says, "Yeah." He says, "Reach in there, wiggle your hands in there." And just, I said, "My hands aren't clean." He says, "Won't matter." He says, "Everything's dirty anyway." And so I got a hold of the baby and I turned the baby in. And I said, "What do I do now?" And she started screaming and the baby started coming in. And he says, "Go on instinct." I'd never been married, never had a child, never been at a birth. And so we got the baby out and he told me how to tie off the umbilical cord and how to cut it and everything. And then he says, "Don't leave because you got to deliver the afterbirth." Mm-hmm. And I says, "What's the afterbirth?" It's funny now. I was scared shitless. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we got the afterbirth out. And we got the baby in her, got the baby all cleaned up and put the baby in her arms. And all the Vietnamese were coming out, pat me on the back. "Good job, Goban. Great, great. You're a great man." And I thought, these people don't know how close I came to peeing in my pants. But that was one of my first experiences. And I found out, it just, you know, after that, I had to, as far as the Daiwi was concerned, I had to officiate at every birth, every death, every wedding, every engagement. And before an engagement could take place, I had to give my approval. And I didn't understand why they were putting me in this position. Because I was just, you know, I was an NCO in the Army. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's their culture. And so I did whatever I could, you know. And that was kind of my introduction to advisory duty, was deliver a baby.
Wow.
And it was kind of funny because I had not met the medic before I went down there. And I didn't know his name was Tom Woods until... oh, I guess it was 1973. I ran into this guy over at the VA hospital in Temple. And we got to talking about Vietnam. And I told him I was on an advisory team. And he told me he was. And he told me what team number. And I said, "Well, that was down in Minto. That was the team I was on." And he said, "Well, what did you do?" And I said, I was the advisor to the riverboat. He said, "Oh, you're that kid that had trouble with his first birth." Hmm. I said, "Was that you, Tom?" He said, "Yep." I said, "Man, I'm glad you were there." So,
how many births did you have while you were there?
One a week, I guess.
Wow.
There was a lot of them.
Wow.
But after that first one, it became common. And I learned a lot about medicine there because my people would get hurt. There was not a medic around. We had a Vietnamese medic, but he wasn't very well trained. And so a lot of times I had to get on the radio and call Tom Wood. And I'd say, "I got this guy down here. His leg's blowing off. What do I do?" He said, "You know how to do a tourniquet. You get something and put a stick in it." I said, "I can do that." He said, "Pour some sulfur powder on it, call a helicopter to pick him up and send him in here." Mm-hmm. That's what I did. And so that's how I learned medicine in the Army, was doing these things with guidance from Tom Wood.
Mm-hmm. Well, just out of curiosity, when you were with USARVI, did you have much enemy contact and did you have to deal with casualties or wounded?
Very little. Mm-hmm. We had very little enemy contact. Most of it was patrolling, searching, not finding anything. Once or twice, we got into a little scuffle, you know, a little firefight. A couple of guys would get hit or something, and medic was there to take care of them, put them on a helicopter and evacuate them out. It's for the amount of time I spent in Vietnam, I can probably tell you that I never spent more than 4 hours over that full period of time, 4 or 5 hours, in contact with the enemy. You would make contact with the enemy, and it was, they would shoot at us, we'd shoot at them, and they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would shoot at us, and we'd shoot at them, kill a couple of them, and it was over.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get into any set battles where we had to defend a position or take a position.
Mm-hmm.
It was small contacts. I think one time we ran into, the biggest contact we ever ran into might have been a 12-man patrol. And
where was that?
That was down in Kiley District,
mm-hmm.
Which was there near me. So
mm-hmm.
we had gone up, we had taken our boats up. Kiley had gotten hit the night before by a probing attack. And we took our boats up on the river and anchored just below Kai Bay. We had landing craft.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up to see if we could find any of the VC. We ran into the VC, a patrol, I guess, about 12 men, maybe. That's what I was told, because I didn't see them. I never saw them that time. What happened is that our point man came around a curve in the trail, and the VC were coming the other direction. And it was so sudden, it scared the crap out of everybody. The VC ran that way, and we went this way. There wasn't even a shot fired.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon I said, hey, why are we running? And the guy told Daiwi, he says, I was scared. And Daiwi explained. He says, it was around a curve. Weren't expecting anything. He says, we all got scared. He said, why did you run, Kovan? I said, I was following you. Not even a shot fired. So we used to go out and set up ambushes at night. And we would go to a village where there was a lot of VC activity.
Mm-hmm.
We'd set up an ambush. Nothing would happen there, but there would something happen over at this village. So we'd go set up at that village. Then they'd come back to this village. And I got the feeling, I really got the feeling that the VC knew where we were going to set up our ambushes. I really got that feeling. Because in all the time that I was over there, we never had an ambush tripped.
Hmm.
Never. One night we got a Jeep with a starlight, searchlight on it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a searchlight that you turn on, but it was a black light.
Mm-hmm.
And we all had night scopes. And we were driving up and down the river in our mic boat, which is noisy as hell at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we took some fire from the shoreline, and we returned it. And we went in, we found two bodies, and we found a whole bunch of bloody trails.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about the extent of that one, you know. It was, I don't think it lasted 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We sure did expend a lot of ammunition. And we took a lot of bullet holes in our boat. We had one guy hit on our boat,
mm-hmm.
got hit in the shoulder. And that was the only casualty we had, was one man.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just wounded. And it wasn't even bad enough. We didn't have him evacuated. We just took him back to the base camp, told him we were coming in. They met us down there with the Jeep and took him to the hospital. But when we examined the site, like I said, we found two dead,
mm-hmm.
and just some blood trails.
How were they dressed? To the
black. They were all in black pajamas.
What kind of weapons?
One of them had an SKS. carbine, and the other one had AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The whole time you were there, whether it was with USRV up in near Cameron and Kamloops, or down in the Delta, did you ever run across any regular Army North Vietnamese soldiers, PAVNs?
We ran into some down in the Delta.
And what time period was that about?
That was just before I left in 68.
Okay, so not early. Not
no,
in 66,
not
67.
No.
It was in 68.
What we were doing mostly, most of our patrols at night mm-hmm. were on the river.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we'd take our boats. We had two LCVPs, which were the old Higgins boats, mounted with 230 calibers.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd put five or six troops in each one with M16s or whatever rifles we could have for the units.
Mm-hmm.
We had some BARs, and a couple of Vietnamese were big enough to handle the BARs.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our big mic boat. It had 250s and 220 mic mics on it, and it had a deck mortar, 82 millimeter deck mortar.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would do is we'd be running around during the day, you know, back and forth on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And when it started to get dark, we would slip into a canal.
Mm-hmm.
And tie up on the side of the beach or along the bank line. And we would put out a small patrol on the bank to make sure that the BC didn't come in on the bank side in ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd sit on the river. And I had a starlight scope. And I would look for sandpans coming down the river
mm-hmm.
at night. And if they were on the river at night, they were targets. Our rules of engagement were very simple on the river.
Mm-hmm.
If they were moving a boat at night, you could open fire on them because they were considered somebody bothering you.
No.
Oh, okay.
It was Mrs. Zumwalt. I was just nodding to her.
But the rule was that if they were on the river, you could open fire on them.
Right.
And it really didn't seem fair because we had those 50 caliber machine guns. And those sandpans weren't that big. And you could really chew one of them up quick. And sometimes, well, most all the time, you'd chew one up at night and the two guys would get away or else they'd be dead. And when you open up with 250 cals and about 35 M16s on a little sandpan, there's not much chance there's going to be anything left. And if there were weapons on it, they probably slipped off and fell into the water, and we weren't going to go diving for the damn things.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't. We, you know, one time, I recall we were out, and it was a big sandpan that came down, was coming down the river. And when we opened up on it, we got a secondary explosion. So we figured it had ammunition on it.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, it was just search.
Mm-hmm.
Go look for it. See if we could find him.
Mm-hmm.
And in 68, the time that we ran into the North Vietnamese unit,
mm-hmm.
we were out on a patrol. Trying to think. I don't have my book in here. We were in the southern portion of the Plain of Reeds in Yao Duc. So we were in the district, Yao Duc district.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the northern portion of Yao Duc district. We had taken our boats up there. 9th Infantry Division had gone up there with us with some of their monitors and their Merrimacks and their troop boats. They didn't put any troops ashore. We took a patrol in of Dai Nguyen and I and 20-25 people, I guess. And we went in into the Plain of Reeds. Now, the Plain of Reeds was a swamp.
Mm-hmm.
Literally a swamp. And so we were moving, just maneuvering around in there. And we spotted five men in khaki uniforms. Mm-hmm. We knew they were NVA because we could tell by the uniforms. Well, we pulled back, and we went to the boats, and I called in right away to the boats. I said, I've got a contact. And I gave them the count that I had, which was five, and the direction they were moving. And the monitors of the Merrimacks went in and set up an ambush. And sure enough, there was at least five platoons behind those five men, five or six platoons. There was 70 or 80 people walking down there. Mm-hmm. And the Merrimacks set up their ambush, and after they they called us and they say, okay, the last man's passed. So we moved our boats back up to where the area where we figured they had gone down. And we were a covering force in case they turned around and tried to get back through.
Mm-hmm.
They let loose. And I guess, you know, they killed them all in the first round of the first volley of fire. Because those monitors and Merrimacks, they were armed with 20 mic mics, they were armed with 50 cals, they were armed with 105 howitzers. And the 105 howitzers were firing the beehive rounds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, they just blew the whole unit away. And they took credit for all the kills because they had killed them. So it didn't matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of the people that was in there was a paymaster, because they got a roster of five or six units in the Delta and the names of everybody in those units. And they used that intelligence to warn other people in other districts, and they went out searching for them.
Mm-hmm.
And found a bunch of them.
Wow.
So, but that was the only time we ran into NVAs.
Okay. A couple of clarifying questions real quick. You did describe the Mike boat and what the other two boats.
LCVP.
LCVP. VP.
And those were the old, what they called the Higgins boats,
mm-hmm.
the old landing craft.
How many boats total were in this 17th Riverboat Company?
Three.
Three boats. Just the Mike boat and the two LCVPs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How many people? How many soldiers? Or
we had 55.
55? And their contingent of family members, how large was the overall compound?
How large was the compound?
Yeah, to include the families and anybody else.
We probably took up I would say our compound was probably about 75 to 100 yards long,
mm-hmm.
and about 50 yards wide.
Mm-hmm. How many people total?
I never counted them.
Okay.
But just about everybody was married, and everybody had about three or four kids.
Okay. So a couple hundred?
Oh, yeah. Probably 300-400 people on that compound.
Okay. And what was the relationship like between your Daiwi and the people and the soldiers that he worked with?
He was a very strict disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
He made them toe the line. And he didn't book with any back talk or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid that his and my relationship was going to be a little strained because, see, I was an NCO and he was an officer. And I felt that he might resent. And at first there was some resentment because they had not sent an officer of equal rank. They still believe in the CHASS system. If you belong in classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out of my class when I was talking to him. Mm-hmm. But after I'd been there a couple of 3 months, he and I started getting along, you know, just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't try to tell him how to do anything. But when we went out, I would get the support that he needed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I could call in gunships. I could call in artillery.
Okay.
And I could get it faster by my calling than what he could.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped. I was able to get med caps. Have you ever heard that phrase?
Yes.
Okay, med caps. I was able to get med caps to come out almost monthly
mm-hmm.
to help take care of the people on the compound with medical problems. I was able to get them food. I was able to get them construction equipment. And we needed construction equipment. We needed to beef up our defenses. Our bunkers were bad and weren't very secure. We hit several. A lot of times now, we would go out. We had a Kit Carson scout with us. Mm-hmm. And you've heard that phrase too. Okay. We hit some pretty big caches. We turned one cache where there was like 10,000 pounds of rice. And of course, an army unit came out and they scooped all the rice up and they took it. We would hit arms caches every once in a while. Mm-hmm. With the arms caches, all the automatic weapons we turned in, all the souvenir quality we kept. And the reason for that was we could not get support for his unit out of the district chief. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have the money to buy what he was supposed to be giving us, mm-hmm. which used to just piss me off. That's a whole new story. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I went to him several times and I said, look, we need concrete, we need new M16 rifles, we need this, we need this. And he told me, he said, well, put in the paperwork. I said, I've got the paperwork. We've put it in three times. He said, well, I don't know what happened to it. And then Daiwee would come back and tell me, he says, don't bother the district chief unless you've got money to give him, because he's not going to give us anything unless we have money. And that angered me. Mm-hmm. Because this was stuff that the son of a bitch was given by the American government, mm-hmm. to give to his people. But he wouldn't let it go unless they bought it from him. That's where the corruption came in. That part of the hierarchy of the Vietnamese is what pissed me off. It's that. I did get my revenge, though. But I used to take, when we hit an arms cache, I'd take the weapons that you could keep for souvenirs. And I bartered for the stuff we needed. Mm-hmm. I would go down to Dong Tam, which was the 9th Infantry Division base camp. And I became very good friends with the portmaster. And I could go in there and he'd say, what do you got today, Sarge? And I'd tell him, well, come down and take a look. He'd go down and he'd look. He'd say, oh, shit, man. I can fix you up. What do you need? You know? I said, well, we need a couple of pallets of concrete, a couple of pallets of sea rations. We need some tin. We need some ammunition. Okay, I think I can handle that. We could get it. He'd take four or five, six weapons, take them into his hooch. All of a sudden, the front end loaders would start hauling shit down, put it on our boats. And we'd have to back our boat back down off the beach, because when you come in, you know, you hit the beach and you drop your ramp. Well, when they start loading all this crap, you're going to start taking water. Mm-hmm. So we would back down until we could refloat the boat, you know, after they loaded everything, we could get out. Mm-hmm. And I was getting cases of M16 rifles. Not just four or five. I mean, cases, a couple of cases of them. Mm-hmm. I was getting pallets of concrete, this pre-mixed concrete. I was getting pallets of ammunition that we needed. We needed ammunition for M1s, and we needed ammunition for BARs. We needed stuff like that. And he was giving it to us. I didn't ask him where it came from. He didn't ask me where the weapons came from. But that's how we did it. And I'd always get one or two cases of sea rations. And this was the thing that was really fascinating about the Vietnamese. We could give every family a case of sea rations. And they could make a case of sea rations last a month. Whereas a case of sea rations was good for 12 days for an American soldier. But they could take a family of six and feed them for a whole month in a case of sea rations, which, you know, was fascinating to me that they could make them last that long, but they could. Mm-hmm. One time we hit a good arms cache in Kai Bay. We'd been up on one of the canals. We'd made contact with a couple of VC. We chased them. Couldn't catch them. But anyway, some of the guys started nosing around in one of the dry spots there. Mm-hmm. And we found some bunkers that hadn't been abandoned too long. We found a bunker complex. And one of the guys went down into the tunnel and he found an arms cache with a lot of stuff in it.
Hmm.
A lot of good collectible stuff. We found some German World War II Schmeisser submachine guns.
Mm-hmm.
We found Lugers down in there. We found Red Star pistols down in there, the 9mm. We found SKS, CKS, AK-47s, all kinds of explosives. And so we took out everything.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that we could use for training material, we put on a boat, and then we called helicopter in to pick everything up. Well, of course, the district chief got credit for this arms cache. It was huge. We had any aircraft, I think there was 30mm any aircraft, a couple of those aircraft guns in there on wheels. We took a big arms cache and took it, turned it in. It's all flown back to METO, and they inventoried everything. Well, we took all the good stuff. And I went down to the RMK BMJ compound, which was the civilian contractor. Oh, those civilians just loved a lot of things, especially weapons they could take on.
Mm-hmm.
I swapped. Well, I got the contractor to come out to my compound. He built us four corner bunkers out of steel-reinforced concrete. All of our bunkers up till then had been made out of mud, river mud,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty hard stuff. After they built the bunkers, we covered them up with mud again. But we put a 50 cal in every corner bunker, something we'd never had in our corner bunkers before.
Mm-hmm.
We came across a four-deuce mortar with a lot of high-explosive rounds. Mounted that in our compound. That's where my infantry training came in. See,
mm-hmm.
I knew how to set my mortar in. I knew how to put out my aiming stakes. And I knew how to build the mortar pit. I knew how to set up perimeter defenses and things like this. So we were able to improve on these things. We were also able to put out our... we got our concertina wire put out.
Mm-hmm.
We mined the concertina wire in certain ways so that if they messed with the wire, we could get mined explosions.
Mm-hmm.
We set out food gas containers. Thank God we never had to use them at that compound, but we had them.
Mm-hmm.
But that was where a lot of my infantry training came in. You know, we had been taught in infantry basic how to do a lot of this stuff. And I was able to help them with this. Before I got there, they had two wires out, and it was very easy to get through the wire. Why they had never been hit, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The Tet Offensive, we got some fire, but most of the Tet Offensive was all concentrated in METO. They kind of left us out there by ourselves because I guess they figured if we can capture METO, we don't need him because
mm-hmm.
it's just a small compound. But that's how I got back at the district chief. I told you I got my revenge on that son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
After I got that four deuce mortar in,
mm-hmm.
One of my aiming stakes, I had sent four of my NCOs from the boat company over to METO, to the district headquarters compound, and I had them pace off where the warehouses were from the headquarters unit. And then we did some other measurements. We had people walk back and forth to town,
mm-hmm.
To the compound and pace it off.
Mm-hmm.
And the night of the Tet Offensive, damn, we accidentally dropped 8 rounds of 4-deuce mortar on the compound. Every warehouse. You know what I did, don't you?
Mm-hmm. But why don't you explain it?
Explain it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some bitch wouldn't give it to us.
Yeah.
He wanted us to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I just figured I wasn't going to buy it, and nobody else would, if we blew the shit out of it. So we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we blew the shit out of the 8 warehouses. Four deuce mortar in every warehouse and set them on fire and fucked up everything in there. After Tet was over, Diane and I walked over to the compound and stood there and laughed.
Mm-hmm.
I think they think Charlie did that.
Okay. Now, two questions about the district chief. One question about the district chief and another question about the VC. When you were calling in for fire support, what kind of authorizations did you have to get through the district level in terms of bringing in artillery or bringing in airstrikes?
I didn't go through that.
Okay, you never did have to go through the district?
That we had to.
Okay.
He had to go through his district.
Okay.
To get permission to fire.
Okay.
I had direct communication with the 84th Artillery
mm-hmm.
out of Dongtown.
Okay.
Let's just say that they took home some nice souvenirs.
Okay.
And I could call them up, and I'd call in for a fire mission,
mm-hmm.
give them grid coordinates, and then fire the mission.
Okay.
That's how I got my fire mission.
But officially, you were supposed to go through as well?
Yeah, officially I was. But officially, it would have taken me 4 or 5 hours to get the permission.
Right.
And I'm sure Charlie wasn't going to hang around for no. 4 or 5 hours.
No. No, I just wanted to show the dichotomy of the two.
Yes.
Because I was under the impression that that was the case.
That was the case.
The district
chief
was supposed to authorize all
I was supposed
fire
to
support
get, Yes, I was supposed to get the district chief to give me authorization for all fire support.
Mm-hmm.
And so I laid that on Dai Wei's shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And Dai Wei would call the district and tell them what we needed and how soon, you know, we're in contact, we need fire support.
Right.
Or we need helicopter support or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I won't pretend to know what was going on. I did have one guy tell me that when a request came in,
mm-hmm.
they would go over to a map, they would look at it, they would plot it on the map, and then they would search all intelligence reports to see if you were in contact with the VC before they would fire the mission. Because the senior district advisor for the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
He had to account for every round of ammunition. So he didn't want to waste it. So while Dai Wei was calling them, I'd call the 84th Artillery Regiment over at Dongtown.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I had to do is I had to authenticate that we were in contact.
Okay.
Do you have contact? Yes, I have contact. Has anybody been killed yet? No, but it's getting pretty hairy out. Oh, okay. We'll fire one round for adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put a Willipeter in there for adjustment. You adjust and give us the fire mission.
Okay. Did you ever bring in air support?
Yeah.
I mean, not medevac or anything like that, but air support?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I called in. We were... down at Yao Duck. And RFPF compound was getting hit one night. We had a patrol in the area. When they called us and told us that they were getting hit, they only had like 25 people on this outpost.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they were taking fire from three sides. Our patrol came in from the one side where they weren't getting fire, and they had no Americans with them. And so I got in, and Dai Wei was with us, and Dai Wei talked to the commander. He said he needed help because he couldn't hold them off. There were too many. So I got on the radio, and I got a hold of the Seawolf compound down at Vinh Long,
mm-hmm.
where they stayed. I gave them my call sign. Well, as soon as I gave the Seawolves my call sign, they knew who I was. And they launched aircraft right away.
Mm-hmm.
They put, I think, 6 aircraft in the air. And they got on the horn because they were in the air. They called in an Air Force FAC.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force FAC came in, come up on the line. So they would come in, make their runs. The Air Force FAC would bring in some SPADs to make their runs.
Mm-hmm.
And contact was broken. We waited maybe 10 minutes and Spooky came in. And Spooky made a complete circle, 360 degrees twice around our compound, sprayed it. No more problems. We went out the next morning, we found no bodies, no weapons. We found a few helmets, bloody bandages, and a lot of blood trails.
Mm-hmm.
So we know we hit something out there. And I don't think that lasted more than half an hour, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
From the time we got word they were contacted till the time it was all over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. The contacts were so short. If they could hit an outpost and overrun it in the first 2 minutes, they would take it. But if the outpost was able to get support and resist, if they couldn't take the outpost, like I said, within a few minutes, they would break off contact and leave.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm saying, I don't think my contact was over 4 hours all the time I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't seem like we had a lot of contacts, but they never lasted long.
They weren't pitched campaigns or pitched battles.
No, they were not pitched. We could never get them into continued firefights. If we could have ever drawn the VC or the NVA into a firefight where we had them pinned down and they couldn't move and break contact, we could have brought a lot of
mm-hmm.
support in and probably done some damage. But they didn't fight like that.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, when you left, did you feel like, what did you think? I mean, here's a very elusive enemy, hard to pin them down and bring what firepower was available to bear on them. How did you feel when you left? Did you feel like this was a winning war, or?
Do you want me to answer your question?
Read my shirt.
Old non-vet. I don't know what happened, but when I left, we were winning.
That's right. We had so little contact after the Tet Offensive. They had no way to really fight the war anymore. And if you look at the history of the Tet Offensive, everybody says we lost the Tet Offensive, which is not true. We won the Tet Offensive. We killed, and I'm saying we, the
mm-hmm.
armed forces that were there, the people that were fighting on the ground, killed so many NVA and VC.
Mm-hmm.
We almost destroyed the entire infrastructure of the VC and the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
There were, I don't know what the body count was from the Tet Offensive. It was tremendous. The VC were practically wiped out. The NVA, it took them, 5, 6 more years, 3, 4, 5 years before they were able to really mount another major attack, and that didn't come until 73. The infrastructure of the Viet Cong, it took them that long to rebuild what damage had been done during the 68 Tet Offensive. So when I left, there was very, very little contact.
Mm-hmm. But the other side of that coin is, of course, I think it's been recognized fairly well, that militarily, the U.S. military, the South Vietnamese military won the Tet Offensive. The defeat came in the popular perception of what was happening, especially in the minds of Americans back on the home front. And in March of 68, after the Tet Offensive was over, Johnson made his announcement that he was not going to seek re-election. Psychologically, these things had very powerful effects on how the U.S. could continue prosecuting the war.
Mm-hmm.
When you left in October of 68, had you sensed anything in terms of an effect on the U.S. and activity in Vietnam at that point?
I had not.
Okay.
I knew we were still getting a lot of support. I knew that we were still being highly, very well supported. I wasn't privy to newspapers, radios, and stuff like this, television, news. We didn't have it.
You didn't have a portable radio?
No.
Okay.
I was too involved in doing things on the compound.
Right.
So I didn't even have a portable radio. The only time I got to listen to a radio was, I think, when I went to the team headquarters. And most of that was all music.
Mm-hmm.
Things, music being played. So I got some news from home. My father, having been a combat veteran, sent me very little news from home. Because he did not want to interfere with my feelings. In other words, he wasn't trying to sway me. I think the broadcast people are the ones that said we lost the Tet Offensive. I'm blaming the media for that. And the reason for that is the Tanzanute incident, when the VC hit the Tanzanute. There was a mass grave out there that was humongous. But when the media got out there a couple of days afterwards and they were taking pictures, they were saying, look at these poor civilians slaughtered. Of course, they were dressed in trousers and a shirt, you know, everyday wear. And they had no weapons with them. So they were civilians, right? And that's what the media was reporting. They forgot to mention that these were soldiers, in that prior to their coming out there, they had been stripped of all of their military equipment. They failed to report that. So,
yeah, the media had an effect.
The media had a big effect on the American people. I had a chance later in the years to view a lot of the stuff that was filmed and sent to the TV stations. I got some of the stuff. And the famous picture of the GI standing there with his lighter lighting the hooch, that was staged. That was a staged photograph. They had talked the GI into setting fire to the hooch so they could picture it. But that's not the story they told. So that was one thing. Another famous picture involved General Schwarzkopf, but not when he was a major and he was advisor, I believe an airborne advisor in Vietnam. When the airplanes went in and bombed the napalmed this village, the story was that this little girl running naked, you know, this innocent child. They had done everything they could to get those villagers out of that village. They would not leave the village because they were communist sympathizers, and they knew as long as they were there that nobody could bring artillery on them so they could protect the VC. Well, Major Schwarzkopf didn't see it that way. And he called in some air support. And that's how that child got burned. It was because of her family, her parents, were VC sympathizers. But they blamed that on us.
Well, speaking of VCs, the VC, Viet Cong, you mentioned that it was very rare, if I guess maybe it didn't even happen at all, that the VC stumbled into your ambushes when you were with the 17th Riverboats.
Yeah.
Did you ever come to suspect that perhaps the reason for that was there might have been a VC who had infiltrated the unit and was basically tipping them off?
No.
Nobody else
was getting contacts on their ambushes. We would have out...
But again, the same thing.
Our team infiltration
of all the units.
Yeah, but a VC to hit... I mean, every unit that had an ambush out? No.
Okay.
I mean, We went out ambush after ambush after ambush after ambush at night. we would set up in one area,
mm-hmm.
right? As soon as it got dark, we'd pick up and sneak over here.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no way for an infiltrator to put out that information that we had moved.
Okay.
And we still couldn't catch them because they just weren't running the patrols at night.
Hmm.
Now, on the rivers, every once in a while at night, we would get a couple of three sandpans or one or two or one sandpan or something.
Hmm.
But the infiltration wasn't there. The heavy infiltration wasn't there.
Okay.
I suspect that the infiltration was going on further up, like in 3 Corps, 2 Corps, and 3 Corps,
okay.
where it wasn't going on down in the Delta.
Okay.
Now, they may have been coming across the border at Three Sisters there in the Delta and going south down to the southern part because they had a lot of contact down there.
Mm-hmm.
But over on the eastern side of the Delta, no, we didn't have that much contact.
Okay.
I've got some maps in my car. I can show you some of the areas where we operated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big area,
mm-hmm.
but there were times. I mean, you couldn't make contact all the time, because they knew that we were out there at night looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
So why put yourself in that position? You know, I guess for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many miles was your compound from Amita, from the advisors?
From the advisor headquarters,
mm-hmm.
probably 7-8 miles.
Okay. And how far were you from the next advisor, your counterpart advisor?
That was it. Yeah, that was it.
How many other advisors were working in the area around Mito? With other teams.
Well, now we had. Okay. Let me think now. I'll have to show you the map.
Okay.
But we had. Yadek, Kyle, Kaibe, Ben Tran, Chow Go, Mito, and one other one, I think. So we had 7 compounds.
Okay.
And mine, which would have made 8 compounds.
Okay. And each one of those compounds had an American advisor.
Yeah. The team headquarters in Mito had probably about 10 or 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
The team at Kaibe, and Yaodek, I think, had 6 or 7 people. And I never got to see the other teams.
Okay.
We also had a team of armor advisors in Mito with a Vietnamese armored cav regiment that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if they were with... they were part of our team or another team. We also had the 9th Arvin Regiment, or 9th Armored Arvin Infantry Division there,
mm-hmm.
around in that area. And they had American advisors, but I don't know how many.
Hmm. Okay. This will end the interview with Mr. Fisher on April 20th, 2001.